This podcast is dedicated towards helping individuals that look like you and me to be able to improve our sales skills. We're going to go back in the archive and we're going to pull an episode that was done back on my other show, The Sales Evangelist, where we got a chance to interview Lynn Hart. He was really good friends. One of his best buddies was the richest black man in America. And the experiences and the stories of how he got to that level is fascinating. We're going to hear a little bit about that. Hope you love this one. Hey, 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 everyone. Welcome to another great episode of Selling in Color. My name is Donald Kelly, the Sales Evangelist, and I'm so excited for another great episode. I'm so excited to have you here today. And on today's episode, as I mentioned, this is going to come from the archives of the Sales Evangelist. About 4 years ago, I got a chance to connect with this guy named Lynn Hart. Now, Lynn wrote a book about one of his best buddies, Reginald F. Lewis. And Reginald, this man was quite successful during the 80s. He was the richest black man in the world. He created a $1 billion company known as TLC Beatrice International Holdings. And the things that he was on track to do was just like fascinating, was just like amazing. And, you know, just like a lot of the greats, he got cut down short. But his legacy lives on. And that's why his friend Lynn Hart wanted to tell people about who Reginald was before he got to the fame, before he got to that success level. Who is this individual? What made him the way he was? And how did he develop the character? You're going to hear about that in the book that he wrote. And as he and I had this interview to break down and get a better understanding of Reginald F. Lewis. Hope you enjoy this episode.
Thank you, Donald. It's a pleasure being with you this evening.
Thanks so much. I'm excited to connect with you today because I feel that you have a great story, and you've written a wonderful book about a great individual, and we'll get into that in a second. But one of the things I always ask all my guests on a podcast is to tell me about your coolest sales experience where you were the customer.
Well, I have to go back to get the story that I think is most meaningful, and it took place quite a while ago when I purchased my first computer, and this would have been about 1980. I was told by my brother, who had been involved in computers, that I needed to get a computer. He didn't give me a lot of direction other than that. And in those days, there weren't stores that you could go to and buy a computer. And I ended up working through a gentleman who was who worked at the same company that I worked for. And he was in the purchasing area. He had a daughter who had just been given a job working for this new computer company. And she was going to be made available to me to help me decide how to do this thing and how to order it. I was reluctant because in my experiences, you know, things hadn't always worked well. And so my expectations were pretty low. Well, as it turned out, this young lady was really on the spot. She came over to my office, she sat, we talked, explained to her what I was looking for, and she figured out a package for me, figured out the right computer, and ordered it for me. And I kept thinking this is going to be a nightmare because it'll be a million parts and there'll be stuff I won't know. And well, as it turned out, it was probably one of my better experiences because when it came, it was packaged well, lots of good instructions. She actually brought it over to me and explained to me how to get started, and the purchase price was fine. And in every way possible, that young lady had exceeded my expectations. I think it also is a bit of irony in it because the computer that I bought in 1980 was one of the very first commercial computers manufactured by Apple. If you're old enough, and you're not, but it's the Apple II Plus. And okay. It was Apple's second commercial computer. And I'm going to tell you how well it runs. I still have it today.
No way.
I still have it. It's packaged. I haven't run it in years. But when I put it in the box, I put it in there with expectation that one day I might pull it out again. Now, who knows when, if ever, I'll do that. But the young lady who handled that whole purchase process was exceptional and far and away exceeded my expectations.
That's really awesome. I love the fact what you mentioned is that exceed the expectation, and she made a personal call. She actually came and delivered it.
Yeah.
I think that's really cool and helped you out with different things on how to get it started. So that's awesome. So Lynn, tell our audience more about yourself and who you are.
Well, I'm originally from Baltimore. That's where the Reginald Lewis connection begins. But years ago, I started working for Western Electric and a company that later became AT&T Network Systems. And for people who've been around for a while, you know that we manufactured the telephone equipment for all of the telephone companies when they were in a monopoly arrangement. And I left the company in 1995, and I guess technically I retired. I had close to 29 years service, close to 30 years service. And I decided I wanted to work for myself. And that in itself is an outshoot, an aftershoot of my relationship with Reg, because Reg always talked about working for himself, and I came from a different place, but I always knew I would one day work for myself because Reg was doing it. And so I left the company in 1995, and I started my own company. And basically the company was, I became a professional speaker, and the company delivered speaker services and also later branched off into executive coaching. And that was just an extraordinary opportunity to do some work that I always wanted to do. And I kept at that, traveling around the country speaking. And around 2011, I started to wind that down, and I was getting some requests to put my thoughts and my experiences on paper relative to the Reg and Lewis connection. And I wasn't really committed to doing it until his wife and his mother asked me to do it, because there weren't many guys around who had that close personal connection to Reginald in those days. Because it's not generally known, but Reginald Lewis was an extremely private individual. But the thought was that I could do this. And so I decided to take that on. And so that's how we ended getting this book, Reginald F. Lewis Before TLC Beatrice, The Young Man Before the $1 Billion Empire.
Wow. That's really neat. And that's what I wanted to lead into, was that's the book you wrote, and you and Reginald had a close experience. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about Reggie for those who don't have an understanding of who Reggie was?
Well, Reginald Lewis, and by the way, Reginald Lewis passed away in 1993. And at the time of his death, he was arguably the richest African-American on the planet. He had concluded several business deals, the last of which was a company called, it was actually the International Division of Beatrice Foods. It was an international leverage buyout, which he had concluded and conducted and closed the business. It was a company that was doing in excess of $2 billion of business. And I believe it was something like 63 companies in 30 or so countries. It's an international company. And when he closed the deal, most people didn't realize that he was a young African-American businessman at the time who had orchestrated this thing. So but that's the Reginald Lewis story. He was essentially an extraordinarily successful businessman, extraordinarily wealthy, and passed away, unfortunately, too soon. But our relationship goes back to when we were young men growing up in the same West Baltimore neighborhood. He lived about three blocks from me, and his family had moved into the neighborhood shortly after my family did. And so we would see each other, meet each other kind of casually, and later became friends. We competed against each other in high school and sports. He went to Dunbar High School in Baltimore, and I went to Edmondson High School in Baltimore. And as fortunes would have it, we both won athletic scholarships, football scholarships, to attend Virginia State University. And we became roommates and became close friends. Later, we became fraternity brothers, and we stayed in close contact throughout his career, his life. And there's a letter in the back of the book which was written from Reginald to me 1 year and 1 day prior to his passing, which also adds a little bit of more background about our relationship as young men. But that's sort of the backdrop of our relationship and how it got started.
Now, Reginald has an amazing story as far as where he came from and some of the things that he was able to accomplish throughout his lifetime. And I imagine that's what makes this, you know, the story even so much neater, is that he wasn't born into wealth or born into this, you know, elaborate business, but he had some great things, that some great attributes. And those attributes you feel were developed over that course of that relation, that 10-year period where you got a chance to really know him. And I think that is what would, I feel it would benefit the audience a lot for those who are listening as sales professionals or entrepreneur. What makes individuals successful, and particularly what crafted or helped Reginald to become the individual he was? And if you don't mind speaking to that for a little bit.
Well, yeah, because I think that's a very important question you're raising. And it is at the core of who this man was. Reginald was an unusual person in that he, as you indicated already, he didn't come from any wealth. You know, he had average grades, and he was a guy who would frequently tell you that he was going to be doing something extremely important, if not extremely successful later on in life. But as you listen to him, you often wondered, was that real or was that just kind of like blowing smoke? And there were many times when we thought that's what we were hearing. But Reginald had some other things that made him unique. And I've answered this question before, and I've answered it this way, and I really do believe this, that I've heard people talk about success and their pursuit of it and all the things they claim that they will achieve. But in many cases, those beliefs were not sustainable in the sense that that person didn't have the rest of the equipment to get the job done. I've always described Reginald as someone who had a sustainable belief in the inevitability of his own success. What I mean by that is that he never doubted for a minute that he was going to be successful in spite of those shortcomings I mentioned. It didn't matter what other people said, what other people thought, the stereotypes of the day, racism, nothing was going to stop him. And Reginald's development years, the ones that I write about, are from 1956 to 1965. And there was a lot going on in this country that would have deterred anybody, let alone an African-American, to achieve the kind of success that he achieved. But Reginald was truly one of these out-of-the-box kind of characters. There's always discussions about people who are out-of-the-box thinkers. I've always said Reginald Lewis was more than that. He never saw the box in the sense that, you know, when you talk with him, he was always upbeat about what he was going to do. And you'd say, how can you do that? You don't have connections. You don't have a lot of money. Your grades are just average. But he was exceptional in that he was able to overcome that.
Now, taking that from that part that you just shared there about how he was able to overcome some of that, and you gave some of the, you painted a picture of some of the challenges that was going on in the day and in that time period. Now, we understand that he had that tenacious drive for success. Do you feel that drive can be, anyone can gain that drive or can grow towards that drive? Or was that just something that Reggie was born with?
Well, that's always been a difficult question for me to answer, but I think I have something that at least gives you my take on it. And it's not a scientific thing. It's an observation. It's what I've seen, what I've learned of my years. I believe everybody, all of us, were born with certain instincts. You know, the instinct to survive, you know, and embedded in that is also, I think we all are born with a desire or an instinctive desire to be good at something, whether it's good at sports, whether it's good at walking faster than anybody else, speaking better. I think those things are innate. The trick is to find out what lights our fire. And whether you call it drive or, as I choose to call it, passion, that's the key that propels us to where we want to go in this life. So even with those instincts, without having that passion, something that lights your fire, so to speak, you never get the fuel mixture right to get what we call drive. It's something that I noticed in Reginald Lewis very early on. His passion to be successful was evident, even though those of us who saw him would say, we don't see how that happens for you. So I guess my answer to your question is this. We're all born with certain instincts, but we have to discover the thing that lights our fire. And that requires a certain amount of push, a certain amount of determination. But once that's determined, you know, I think we put ourselves on a path to having not just success, but extraordinary levels of success, which is what he had. Discovering what it was that he could pursue with an extraordinary level of energy, intensity, and that was his passion. And he discovered that. And that was become a lawyer / businessman. And nothing ever deterred him. But so the drive comes from the other components that we discover along the way.
Can you tell us any particular stories or any scenarios you can think about in Reginald's life where maybe just something from your early years with him that you knew that there's something different about this individual?
Well, the first story I would share with you is something that happened, and I have to go back to the time frame again. It was 1961. And if you do the study, you know that was at the height of the beginning of the civil rights movement and when things were starting to bubble over. And we were sort of finding ourselves in the thick of things. And we went to Virginia State University, which is an HBCU, a historically black college. Mm-hmm. And the school is located in Petersburg, Virginia. And Reginald and I were at some point there in our freshman year, we were looking for jobs, you know, we were looking for ways to make some money. And so we decided we would go over to a new bowling alley that had just opened. I think it was called the Skylark Bowling Alley. And we went in there, and it didn't take long to note that this was a predominantly white institution. I mean, I think they had a basic rule that blacks could come in, but there were limitations placed on them in those years. But we went to get a job, and we looked around, and I thought to myself, I don't see anything in here for us to do. Maybe we'll luck out and get a job as maybe work in the counter, cleaning up, pen setters or whatever. And I thought to myself, you know, that's what I see us doing here. To show you the kind of guy Reginald was, and he was a year older than I was, but he was mature beyond his years. He turned to me and he said, I don't want to do any of that stuff. He used an expletive deleted, which I can't say here, but he said, he said, I don't want to do any of that blankety blank. So I thought to myself, I said, well, there you go again, Reg. You're always got to be 20 miles ahead of everybody else. You always got to have the biggest story. And you're blowing smoke again. You know we're not going to get anything other than that. So, well, we didn't get anything that day, but we left. And so several weeks later, I noticed he was coming back on campus late. And I said, what's going on? You find a job somewhere? You got a girlfriend over in town? What's going on? He said, well, you remember that bowling alley, that place you went to? I said, yeah. And he said, well, I'm running that joint. I said, that can't be true. Now, here's the story. He ended up being the night manager over there. Somehow he had wrangled himself into position. And I never knew how he did this, but he was a night manager. And I attested this because he invited me over a couple of times to bowl. But he had positioned himself to do that. Now, that was extraordinary. And I think what it always reflected, I knew then that he was not just talking, because he was doing things while he was talking. But that's an example. And there's one other one I'll give you, which came later in life. I was working for, as I said earlier, AT&T, and I had the responsibility for AT&T's network systems engineering. By the way, this is AT&T before it became today's AT&T. This is during a period when it was the monopoly company, a company of close to 1 million people. And I was working, I had the, this is shortly after. This is after divestiture. It was still a large company, but not 1 million people. But I had the responsibility for the network systems engineering in the western part of the country. I was located here in St. Louis. And as a part of that, I had a little skunk works group of guys who had come up with the idea of providing a service. And the service was what we call propagation studies for cellular towers. The cellular phone business was just starting to ramp up around that time, at least starting to be recognized as a viable service. And so, but the propagation studies were designed to, it was service that went out and did studies to decide where best to place these towers, these cellular towers that you see around when you drive now. Mm-hmm. These guys, I had about 30 or 40 guys who engineered that kind of stuff and went out and as a kind of contractor service, provided that engineering service to telephone companies or anyone else who wanted it. Well, somehow Reginald had heard about this and he called me up. And this is in the mid 80s. He called me up and he said, Lynn, I understand you guys are doing some work with Sailor. I said, what do you think it would take to buy those assets from you? Now, this is a considerable business. And when he was asking me this question, I was thinking to myself, here he is again. He's no way in the world is going to be able to buy these assets. He's just blowing smoke. And we did a little due diligence on him. We found out that, yeah, he could actually afford to buy those assets. And I think, Donald, it was at that time that I realized that he had actually moved into a zone that I was not, you know, I mean, he was playing a ball game that most of us were not able to play. And that's when I knew that this guy is everything I thought he was. He's extraordinary. And there's a picture on my website, on my Facebook page of the two of us, and we were standing there arm in arm, and that picture was taken in 1966, and I told my wife, take this picture, because I do believe Reginald Lewis is going to be somebody special one of these days, and that picture is a picture that's in the book.
Thank you so much for listening and watching this episode. If this is your first time listening to our podcast, I ask you to go ahead and subscribe. And if you haven't done so already, please share it with a friend or colleague, somebody who could benefit from this. You know, our goal here with Selling in Color, we know that there are tons of opportunities out there for us to be able to get into, take advantage of. And I want to make sure we can shortcut that change, shortcut those path. Right now in the sales world, there are only 20% of us who are professional sellers. And we want to change that. We want to make it that more of us are aware of opportunities and take advantage of those opportunities and to accomplish and achieve the success that we know we can. I would love for you guys to go connect with Lynn Hart. He's doing some amazing things. You could check out the book on Reginald F. Lewis. You can get a chance to check out Reginald other books as well, and we'll link to those in the show notes. But this guy, we should never forget him, what he did and some of the great things that he was accomplishing. And our role as individuals right now is that we need to create these type of legacies. And we can make that happen, whether that's in sales or business or whatever form of business that you're in right now. We just need to create legacies like this and create opportunities for ourselves. Reginald wasn't out there begging for a piece of the pie. He went out and created his own pie. And I'm thankful that you're here and thankful that we can help make things like this happen. Appreciate you guys. Look forward to seeing you on part two. I appreciate you listening to this episode today. There are many different things you could be doing, but you took the time to listen to this podcast. And for that, I'm truly grateful. If you haven't done so already, go ahead and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this show. Our show is produced by TSC Studios. Our audio engineer is Jershon Obeil. Artwork and video was designed by the one and only Destin Cunado. Our show note was created by Jake Ligmanowski. Our podcast production manager is Nancy Paul. You can find audio credits to each of our music inside of the show notes. And I'm your host, your coach, your guide down the sales journey, Mr. Donald C. Kelly, the sales evangelist.